Welcome to Really You, a podcast about wearing your voice well, brought to you by Reitmans. I'm your host, Chris Bergeron. In this episode, I'm thrilled to have a conversation with Essie Adoogan, one of Canada's finest writers. Two-time winner of the Giller Prize for her books Washington Black and Half-Blood Blues, Essie Adoogan is renowned for her globe-trotting historical fiction and the thoughtful ways with which she makes Black history come to life. Hello, Essie.
Hello, Chris. Delighted to be here.
You created this wonderful t-shirt with Reitmans, and there's a quote on it. Obviously, you're a writer, so could you talk about the quote and describe the t-shirt and the symbolism of it for us?
Sure. So the quote is a quote from my latest novel, Washington Black, which is about an 11-year-old field slave who makes his way off the plantation into the greater world and sees much more than he could have ever imagined when he was a field slave. Yeah. And the quote is, "Nothing is possible until it is made so." Mm-hmm. And it comes out of a scene in which he's just had this huge revolutionary idea to build an aquarium, mm-hmm. like build the world's first aquarium. And he's told by another scientist that, you know, such a thing has never been produced before. And there are so many obstacles. And he's told, you know, that just won't work. And so then he responds with, well, you know, nothing is possible until you actually do it. And so that's where the quote originates. And I love the shirt. I just think it's so so beautiful and really gets at the book. And we've got, it's a novel that centers around, there's a lot of science, specifically marine biology.
Yeah.
And so we have, you know, we have shells and sea plants and things that represent that. And I believe that it's, the pink is an outline of my face,
which is,
so it all, you know, goes together really beautifully. I'm very happy.
Did you one day think that one of your novels would become a piece of fashion?
No, not at all.
There's something interesting in that, though, that a quote is taken out of context, and now it's going to have a life of its own, independently from the book as well.
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, but it's exciting.
And so the t-shirt is also connected to a cause?
Yes. So the cause is the Victoria Literacy Connection. Yeah. I was a literacy tutor there when I was pregnant with my first child. So about 8 years ago, I used to go every week and teach, I guess, adult learners to read. And, you know, it was something I felt very passionately about, but you know, once I had my child, life kind of got away from me and I had to stop tutoring. And then I understood that the, it's a nonprofit organization and I understood that they were in some financial straits, which was heartbreaking because so many people depended on this service. And, I'm delighted that this is being done.
It's wonderful that you take the time to actually go and teach people, because often authors might stick to academic circles or, you know, writing classes, but for budding authors. Mm. And literacy is something entirely different because you're freeing people at a very basic level when you do this.
I guess so. I mean, it's something that I think when you are highly literate, it's something that you take for granted and you don't really think about how daunting it can be to navigate the world without that very essential skill. Mm-hmm. Like even something like being able to read a traffic sign, you know, could mean the difference between staying safe and having a dangerous situation. And there tends to be, I think with some adult learners who've maybe slipped through the cracks, like they've had all their schooling, but somehow didn't acquire that skill. I think that there can be some shame or embarrassment connected to that that really shouldn't be there. And so I was, you know, it was eye-opening for me to to come and be a tutor, and I felt very humbled. I felt like I was connecting with people, and I think with writing, you tend to sit in a room and yes. and you know, you're by yourself and you're working on something, and you often feel like, how am I making a difference? Mm-hmm. I felt that when I was tutoring, I could see the difference that I was making, and that was very I felt like it was something very essential.
Have any of your past students read your books, or
no?
No, that hasn't.
No, not that I've heard. No.
We're talking about people that fall between the cracks. You do have an interest in your literature. You do look at outsiders quite a lot. You focus on that experience. Why is that important to you?
It's important to me, I think. Probably it comes out of my childhood. I think I was always an outsider.
Yeah.
I was born and raised in Calgary in the 80s. It wasn't a terribly culturally diverse place.
And your parents are from Ghana.
And my parents are Ghanaian immigrants.
Yeah.
First generation Canadian. And maybe there was always this sort of feeling of being a little bit of an outsider. So that's where it comes from. But I think with all of my novels, they've begun from a place of finding somebody who's like a historical footnote or an event that we don't know much about, and then trying to really probe that and investigate that, and then shine a light on that. And that's just always been how I've worked. It's like stories of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
They're great to read, but I'm very, very interested in, I guess, people who have sort of fallen through the cracks of memory.
Is it fair to say that, you know, if your first book, Second Life of Samuel Taine, is something that echoes your family life or your personal life a little bit more on the personal side, and now you're getting into historical, you have been migrating towards historical fiction. Is that something that you think is indicative of just life as an author? The more you are at ease with your craft, the less you have to rely on what's immediately around you?
Maybe. I think there are some writers who just will always, I think of a very close friend of mine, she has to write everything from life. And as soon as she deviates from that, then she finds that she can't write.
Right.
And that's just her particular project and her way of working. And for me, I think I did start with a story that had a few more personal elements for my life, but it was also wildly different from my reality. It was based on the history of Amber Valley, which was this black township that had been in existence at the turn of the 20th century in northern Alberta, and based also on the Silent Twins, who were these English girls who had a hard time, I guess, assimilating into English society. Their parents were, I think, originally from the Caribbean, and then so they formed this very intense bond that just seemed inexplicable to me. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of investigating these things that were divorced from my life, but I guess through the lens of things that were familiar to my own life. And maybe that's something that I'm always doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The research process must be something that's really interesting, because you're looking for stories that people are not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps a part of history that's been overlooked and overshadowed,
mm-hmm.
If only by white figures that tend to write history, mm-hmm. sadly. How do you go about finding those stories?
I mean, I feel like they just sort of fall into my lap in some ways, since, you know, I'm not out there seeking something. As soon as I start to search for something, this is when I know I won't find anything.
Right.
I always have to come across something in a very organic way. So I think for Half-Blood Blues, I was living in Germany, and I started to wonder about the history of Black people in Germany, and then did some research, and then discovered the story of, the children of Black German women and French colonial soldiers who had policed the Rhineland between the World Wars. And I thought that was really fascinating because I didn't know that story. And then for Washington Black, of course, it was the story of Andrew Bogle, who was an ex-slave who was stolen off a plantation by a member of this aristocratic family from the south of England. And that was a story I hadn't heard about, and his connection to the Tichborne claimant trials, which went on forever, and which I also didn't know about. I had no idea about that whole series of trials. So it was these things just, I think, come to you when you least expect them.
How do you navigate the historical aspect of your books, and then the creative aspect, the sort of left brain, right brain balance in your work?
Yeah. I had a very fine teacher when I was at the University of Victoria, Jack Hodgins. He was excellent. And one of the things that he would tell us was, I guess with any fiction, where there's any kind of research involved, mm-hmm. that you do your research, and then when you sit down to write, you try and forget everything. Mm-hmm. And basically what he was saying is that, you know, everything should feel organic. You shouldn't feel like you're transposing facts from a history book into your own work, because it's going to feel, clunky, for lack of a better word. Yeah. So for me, the research process starts like a year before I actually sit down to write. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning all that I can. And then when I sit down to write, I'm not necessarily always consulting, the books that I've been reading. And if I make a mistake, I know that I can go back later. And that's what the editorial process is all about, is I can go and double check the facts that I've maybe, I didn't remember. And so I guessed at them. But there's that process of forgetting, I think, that needs to happen so that everything feels like it's true and real and lively.
And I'm sure you have to give yourself the right to take liberties with history as well.
Yes, definitely, but with the caveat that there are certain things that you can never take liberties with.
No.
For instance, there are certain details. Just looking at Washington Black, certain details of plantation life and slave experience and similarly in Half-Blood Blues, all of the research to do with the Holocaust, these are things that must be absolutely right, because if not, you risk dishonoring the memory of those who lived through it.
Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about voices in this campaign.
Mm.
We're showcasing seven women who have a strong voice. And obviously, you have a voice as an author, but you have that added privilege of being able to take other people's voices. You get to slip into the skin of men, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is your voice, and what is the voice that is created in your work?
That's an interesting question. I feel like I've worked with many different characters' voices. They're all distinct and very much their own thing and coming out of their own eras. But I think underlying that, I think what you're saying is absolutely right, that there is my voice, and that my voice is what's punctuating all of those works, and it's what's underlying them. And I think my voice is simply my worldview, my perspective, my feelings about issues to do with race, gender, all of these things are the voice that sort of connects these very disparate literary voices.
You're such a huge success, obviously. You must have read a lot of reviews and articles. And
no,
you haven't.
I don't read them.
So,
no.
Oh well, that's wonderful. So you don't see how people react to your voice, or
So I sometimes, like, an agent or a friend will read a review that they're very excited about, and then, you know, they'll insist that I read it. And so those ones I do read. But generally speaking, I feel I'd go insane if I read my reviews. Even positive reviews can maybe put something in your head, like, oh, I was praised for X, maybe I should repeat X. Or obviously, when you're not praised, that also stays with you. And so I sort of... my husband reads all my reviews, and I have a gist of what's going on. But generally speaking, I don't read them, and I'm also not on Facebook or Instagram, and I just sort of have to create a bit of a buffer in order to have, like, a safe space to create.
It's important to create that bubble.
Yeah.
To protect yourself.
Yeah.
If not, just there's too much noise.
Yeah.
And have you seen? Are you aware of your evolution as a writer? How does that balance between consistency and innovation, in a sense? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I guess I don't. It's been my way to not think of my entire oeuvre when I'm writing a book is just to be, like, to let myself run away with whatever it is that I'm interested in at that moment. And I think this is why my books have been so hugely different from one another. Like, I think there was
that's what I'm saying, because you reinvent yourself.
Somebody paid me a lovely compliment by saying, like, they read as though they could have been written by totally different people, like all three, which I kind of like that. And again, I think part of creating that safe space is so that I feel free to be able to do that and to be able to run with something that is totally unlike everything I've done before, but without having to worry how people will take it, I guess. Yeah, just to follow my interests.
Do you feel that as a woman writer, you have some kind of added responsibility, or I don't know, some kind of sense of solidarity that has to come through the writing?
No, I really don't.
Yeah. It's funny, because when I read Half Blood Blues, which was, what, I guess 6-7 years ago it came out, I wasn't even aware that you were a woman, because I got it on my Kindle. I barely looked at the name.
Yeah, you know, so I did an event last night, and somebody came up and said, I've read both of your books, and again on a Kindle, and she said, I only realized last week that you were a woman, which, you know, I take that as a compliment, I guess, because maybe it tells me that you thought the voices were authentic. But I don't know. It's, for some reason, those books have just... been very, I guess, voiced by a male presence, but that's just how they came out.
Well, it's a testament to your talent. And actually, there's this quote of yours. It says, "Reading about someone who is completely unlike yourself can be revolutionary," which I think there's a bit of that in there as well. Your ability to create these very unique voices.
Yeah, I guess I think writing about somebody who's unlike yourself can be revolutionary for the writer too.
Yeah.
I think about it like that. Yeah.
Because you create, you bring to the attention characters that have a relationship to the world that you don't see in other books as much. Especially today, there might be a trend towards more autobiographical type of books, things that are very close to home. But there seems to be maybe I'm gushing a little bit too much. but a sense of epicness, maybe even in your work. There it's interesting, because it's very intimate, but you feel the breadth of history throughout.
Thank you.
There's a great motion going through it.
Yeah, I feel like when I'm writing, like I'm trying to hit as many notes as I can. So I do want something that feels at times really intensely intimate, maybe even raw at times.
Yeah.
But also something that feels huge and wide and where you can see how this person's life connects to, I guess, to the greater trends of their era. Yeah, I really like to hit both notes because the books that I like to read when I was growing up hit those notes.
There's something cinematic about your writing. I don't know if that's a compliment for a writer. I don't know.
I'll take it.
How have if any, personal struggles entered your literature or tinted the your choice in stories or the way you voice your characters?
Yeah, I think it goes back to when we were speaking about these marginalized characters or people who feel themselves to be standing kind of outside the circle, as it were. I think that's, that's very much me. Mm-hmm. As a child, as an adolescent, being somebody who, just... It didn't maybe always fit. the square peg going into the round hole. I think that this has really been the reason why I've gravitated towards those kinds of stories.
And now you find, and it's been a couple of years now, that you found yourself in a position when you get accolades. And so what happens when you're the outsider and all of a sudden you're not only on the inside, but you're at the heart of Canadian literature? I mean, winning the Giller Prize and things like that really puts you right up there on the podium, which...
Yeah, but I don't see myself as being... like at the heart of Canadian literature. I live in Victoria, okay. BC. I don't even live in Victoria. I live slightly outside the city. Yeah. I have the same friends that I've always had. They don't think I'm anything special. I'm just me. And my partner, who's also a writer, he's really the main person that I share my work with. And it continues to be that way. And I read his work. And so it really feels, I think in a lot of ways for me, like it's business as usual. Mm-hmm. Although I do have an awareness that things have changed.
Yeah.
But just, the way that I continue to live my life on the coast is, I have all the same friends. And so I think that's maybe part of creating that bubble or continuing to have that safe bubble.
Building a community.
Yeah, building a community or sustaining the community that I built like 20 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, and making sure that I'm still connected to everybody who I've always loved and continue to love and trying to make time for everybody. And I think that just keeps you... Well, that's, it's love, and it's really why you're alive, is to continue to connect with people who you have always loved.
A lot of the women that I spoke to in the past couple of days for this podcast talk about having a safe space, which goes back
that's
to what we're talking about right now. What does your safe space look like? What are the ingredients of a safe space for you?
I like that question. I don't think I've ever been asked it. For me, it's people are so much the bedrock of that safe space. Mm-hmm. So my husband, my children, and my dearest friend, Jeff, who I've known for so long. And, I've had a friend who I've known since we were four, and she's still my friend to this day. And just having those people in my life is so important. But also I'm very, very connected to my physical world, like the world both outside my house, which, I mean, we live right above a bird sanctuary, so I feel very connected to the nature of the West Coast. But also to my home and my office, my home office, which just feels like as soon as I close the door, it feels like I'm in a space where I can really be free to do, you know, to write and think anything I like. And that's huge for me, that I continue to have that space.
People forget that writing is physical.
Mm.
It depends a lot on your environment and what stimulates you on your senses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And there are times when I feel like, you know, even just to be at home in my office is too quiet a thing. And like, you know, when I feel like I have to get more energy up, then I'll go out and write in a cafe or something. Or like, yeah, there are definitely different settings engender different kinds of writing, I think. Yeah, for sure.
Now, obviously, we're talking very quietly about safe spaces, but there is power in your literature as well. What's your definition of power? What how is somebody powerful in your world?
I think somebody is powerful when they are self-assured enough to understand that to go through the world in a kind way, in meeting out kindness, and is strength. That,
right.
That going through the world without doing any harm and trying to create comfort for others, that to me that is real power. I mean, we tend to talk about power as though it's especially these days,
yeah.
As though it's, you know, has something to do with aggression. And I think that that's a kind of superficial power that some people can wield, but that will ultimately fall apart because nobody likes to capitulate endlessly to somebody who's aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I've just, you know, I've seen it. I've been so inspired by my mother-in-law, who is very kind and has always lived her life on these terms. And she's probably the most powerful person that I can think of.
Your mentor, in a way?
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of ways.
And do you get to mentor somebody as well? Are you passing this knowledge on?
You know, I get to mentor my children, I guess.
That
my daughter.
That is the most important thing.
And my son. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting, this notion of kindness, and it's something that everybody is. I was talking to Julie Black about 2 or 3 hours ago, and she has a tattoo of a bridge on her arm, and saying that the world needs more bridge builders. Do you find that in the context of, well, as you were saying, that's a little bit aggressive, the definition of power as aggression. Are you optimistic? You're a student of history. You can see sort of the bigger picture. Where do you feel the world is going, and specifically for women?
Yeah. You know, I feel so much despair these days about the state of the world. And my husband, too, he's actually stopped reading the news just because he said he was just getting so depressed. I don't know. It's hard to sort of, when you're in the middle of something, to kind of quantify things and really have a feel for where they will end up. But I feel like, you know, societies have been through dark moments before, and there's been a correction towards justice. Sometimes the correction comes at great cost, in the case of war, which I hope you know isn't the case. But I just have to trust that things will, I guess, bend towards justice. I think there's that the lovely Martin Luther King quote, which I won't quote here because I'm going to butcher it because I don't have all the word. But just, you know, that the trend of things, you know, will always move towards a place of justice. You know, I believe that. I really do believe that. And in part because of what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, power in the guise of aggression, in the form of aggression, is something that cannot be sustained.
Mm-hmm. And through your writing and through your speaking, you help tilt the balance a little bit more, perhaps, towards justice. Do you recognize that in your life? Or
I don't know. I don't know.
Do you need people to tell you?
You know, I think probably every literary writer hopes that's the case, but one can't really say if one is doing any good. And I know so many writers who despair of that thing that we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, is what I'm doing actually helping somebody? This kind of a feeling, like you don't see an immediate, you know, it's not like being a doctor or something where you can kind of see the results. So
we spoke a lot about kindness. What should we do to amplify each other's kindness?
That's a lovely question. I guess listen. Yeah. Listen more. And try and listen with an open heart and an open mind. I really feel like reading, and that's reading fiction, nonfiction, is something that opens me up to others' experiences. You know, when I read a memoir by somebody whose life is completely different from mine, or even a work of fiction, you know, I feel transformed sometimes by that. Mm-hmm. So that's a way of listening to others' experience. But I really think that that's the key thing, is to listen.
Mm-hmm. And let yourself be transformed by the experiences of others.
Yeah. Or let yourself be exposed to them in any case. Yeah.
Well, words of wisdom. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
It was a real pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, I had fun.
Yay.
Thank you. Those were great questions.
Thank you.